I've been beginning each session with a joke because the doctor from Fordham University said you live longer if you laugh. So my humor has been corny, but we have managed to laugh. So hopefully we've all extended our lives a little bit. Now, the story is told of the bishop who was making his rounds visiting the congregations that were under his supervision. And he contacted the pastor of this congregation. He told him that he was going to be coming through on a certain date, that he would preach for him that Sunday so that the local pastor could get a break from his preaching duties. Well, the Sunday arrived and the attendance was dismally low. In fact, only a handful of parishioners showed up that Sunday morning. And usually they had several hundred that were in attendance. So after the service, the bishop, who was disappointed in the turnout, asked the pastor, "Well, didn't you tell them I was coming?" And the pastor said, "No, Bishop, I didn't tell anybody about it, but the word must have leaked out anyway." During these days, I've tried to share some things about who I am by telling you something about people and something about places that have been important to me, that have helped me to become the person I am. I've shared two people each day and two places that have been a part of my experience. The people I'd like to talk about today are Art Prail, who was a pastor when I came to the University of Iowa. He was a grandfather type of person. He was an excellent theologian and pastor. He loved students. He directed many students to seminary. In fact, Luther College honored him with a Doctor of Divinity degree because of his work with students. He was the person who married Karen and myself. He gave me a model for what a pastor could and should be. The second person is my dad, Russ Carr. He was a person who had a tough childhood and youth. He was the youngest of seven, and so he had to stay at home and take care of his war-pensioned father, who had been wounded in the Civil War and really never had gainful employment. He just had kids who worked and supported him. He went to school through the eighth grade, and that was fairly common in those days. As soon as he got out of school as an eighth grader, he bought his first truck. He got into the trucking business, and he was ripped off by the local banker. He paid for the truck apparently three times over, and it was because he was a young person, and there weren't quite the same banking laws then that we have today. Another thing that was a learning for me about him: he was a non-Swede in a Swedish community. And when they didn't want him to understand what was going on, they simply spoke Swedish. He lived on the wrong side of the tracks, and if you want to complicate the picture, he married the only daughter of a Swedish immigrant couple. Six boys and one girl, and this foreigner, as it were, married the daughter. My dad was a very compassionate man. He was a square dealer in business. He was a workhorse. He was very independent. He did not want to be obligated to other persons. He was very tolerant of long hairs. In that period when young people were growing hair down to the middle of their back, he was not critical of them like many in the adult community. They had very little good to say about youth, and my father was able to see beyond the veneer of long hair and what that might represent to what was beneath that, and that was, of course, young people with great potential. My dad gave me a model of what a man and what a father should be. Places in my life: Berlin. My first trip to Europe, I met with one of our former campus pastors, Manfred Baumann, who used to serve at Stanford University and was serving as pastor of St. Thomas Kirche, which is a congregation that was built right on the Berlin Wall. The wall came right behind the parish, and when the wall was put up, 1948, half of the parish was in the east and half was in the west. The impressive thing about that was in the churchyard, there's a white wooden cross. And on the cross is tacked a photograph of a young man and some wilted flowers. And this was to mark the place where this young man died trying to get across to the west from the east. He was shot, he made it over the wall, fell into the churchyard, and died. And what impressed me about that was the value of freedom and its cost. And there was no more striking symbol of the divided world and people than that Berlin Wall. The second place is Chicago, where I live and work these days. It's a great and a beautiful city. In fact, the view of the Chicago skyline from Lake Michigan is second to none. I think it rivals any view of any city in the world. It's a great city with great problems. There are too many poor, there are too many hungry, there are too many unemployed. Manufacturing and industry are moving from the Rust Belt to the Sun Belt. I've learned what it means to be a commuter since coming to Chicago. I ride nearly 2 hours each way to get to work and back. I've also learned that even though your vita indicates you're qualified by your experience to do a job, that you still have to learn the job. And my guess is we may all be better acquainted with Chicago if it's named as the headquarters for the New Lutheran Church. Well, as a brief review through these hours we've spent together, we've taken a look at the challenge of the campus today. And we've defined challenge as a difficult, a trying, and a testy hurdle to be overcome, to be crossed, sort of like a Mount Everest, rather than the dictionary definition of challenge, which is to lay down a gauntlet. We've considered some of those challenges in the world of higher education: the challenge of struggle, the challenge of ideas, the challenge of identity, and the challenge of protest. And today we're going to talk about the challenge of ministry, the community of the called and their vocation. What we've tried to say throughout this is the challenges really highlight possibilities as well as problems. When you think of Mount Everest, you tend to think of problems. But what we've tried to say is challenges are really fraught with possibilities. The task of the Christian and of the church is to address those challenges in the faith and to do so with confidence in God's empowerment and grace, and we call addressing those challenges ministry. And that's what our topic is today. Campus ministry is a ministry of the church on college and university campuses. We who serve in campus ministry were sent by the church to be there. Now, there's a distinction between being sent and being called. We say that a pastor is called when there's a resident congregation or a group that can do the calling, an organized group that can do the calling. And many of our staff are instead sent, much more like a missionary in world missions. Now, there isn't always that congregation that can do the calling, but instead it's the church at large that does the sending. And as such, then our campus pastors become ambassadors in that place. We in campus ministry may do some things in new and different ways. We may be involved in a ministry which at times does not really resemble parish ministry. But I think the point is that we are the church's ministry in that place, as servants who lead, as proclaimers who listen, as prayers who act, and as thinkers who laugh and celebrate. Don Shockley, who's the chaplain at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, who's a creative Methodist campus pastor, says this, I think, very well. This is what he wrote. We are sent out to the unfamiliar, indifferent, even hostile arenas as representatives of the church in its more familiar forms. But we are not sent merely to protect the church's children who have ventured there. We are sent rather to be in ministry to the locals who inhabit those spaces, whoever they may be. The church at the center, in supporting us, has to take the risk that we will go over to the other side, adopt alien ways, allow the gospel to mingle with other stories, and become something else. But given trust and support, we will bring home more than we take away. We may, in fact, bring home a fuller understanding of the gospel itself. Now, this is the challenge of ministry. What I propose to do is to take 6 challenges and to briefly examine each one of those today. They're challenges to campus ministry, to the ministry of the church that goes on at state universities and privately supported universities, not the colleges of the church. Hopefully through this we'll be able to see some challenges for each of us as Christians as well, not simply the ministry which is done in our behalf or that we participate in on the college campuses of the land. Well, first of all, the church. We're sent to the campus by the church, and the church appreciates this, I believe, and appreciates our ministry. But by the same token, that church which sent us does not always understand us. And perhaps that lack of understanding is because we're often so like and yet so unlike the parish ministry. And parish ministry, as you know, is the center and the norm of ministry in the church. Many members and leaders do not understand the things that we do, and they just can't seem to understand why we don't simply clone the ministry activities that go on in a parish and transport them to the campus. Perhaps some church persons fold us because we are unable to do for their youth what the parents and the whole local congregation could not do. And that is make them active church attenders at worship and at ministry activities. Campus ministry does its ministry in a different context and setting in the parish, so one would not expect them to be identical. Tertullian, a church father in about the year 200 AD, used a paradigm which may help us to understand the relationship and the contrast between the local church and campus ministry. Tertullian used Jerusalem to represent Mother Church. Jerusalem was the norm, the standard for ministry. Jerusalem, where there was a relatively homogeneous constituency based on shared assumptions of what the church is, and having an established order for how things are done. Peter, as you recall, led the Jerusalem church and insisted that converts had to become Jews before they could become Christians. And what that did, it bred a great homogeneity there. They had a common background and a common religious language and common symbols, and they understood one another. Now, contrasted to the Jerusalem church, was the church at Athens and Corinth. These were Greek cities. These were mission outposts. These were new, struggling congregations with new Christians. They were started by Paul, and as you recall, Paul said you didn't have to become a Jew first. You could become a Christian directly, as a Greek, as a resident of any of the countries in that part of the world. And so the constituency was in great flux. It was very diverse. It was very heterogeneous. There were few assumptions which were held in common about churchly things. If you read Paul's letters to the Corinth Christians, it gives you a clue as to their heterogeneity, because they needed help with all kinds of common problems in congregational life. They didn't know how to handle finances. They didn't understand the Lord's Supper and what it meant, things which were very basic essentials to congregational life. Now the parish is much more like Jerusalem, and campus ministry is much more like Athens and Corinth. As you recall, Paul's mission congregations, the least successful numerically, was Athens. That was where wisdom and philosophy prevailed. Things that worked in Jerusalem apparently did not work at Athens and Corinth, and vice versa. And yet the community of faith at Athens and Corinth were the church just as much as the group at Jerusalem, and they supported one another. St. Paul was constantly sending his colleagues with gifts back to Jerusalem to help the poor there. Campus ministry appreciates the continued support of the parishes and the church bodies and their willingness to risk to even have a campus ministry. This is particularly true of the Lutheran church bodies in this country. Many of the other Protestant denominations have made radical cutbacks in their campus ministry efforts. The Lutheran Church has not made these cutbacks. Instead, it has increased its financial support of campus ministry, even though the increases were minimal and couldn't keep up with inflation factors. But the challenge we face is to share our story of ministry more clearly and, I think, more frequently with church leadership and the congregations. We deal with different constituencies which call for different ways of doing ministry. Secondly, the university. The church's ministry on campus is often seen as an appendage by many folks in the university. We're viewed as being on the edge, not at the center of what the university is and stands for. Our campus facilities, I think, give a concrete gestalt or form for that being on the edge. The campus centers are always not on university property, but always on the edge, as close as they can get to the campus. And this is due in part to the understanding of the separation of church and state, but I think it also indicates an attitude toward the church. There were those in the university community who say that the church is in the preaching and the saving business, and the university is in the teaching and the learning business. And in this viewpoint, the church really doesn't belong on campus, because it's there to preach and to save, and that really doesn't have much to do with higher education as they view it. But the church does not believe that it's smuggling alien contraband onto the campuses. We don't take God to the university or to the world because we believe that God is already there. And we believe that there's a resident Christian community already there through the Christian students and Christian faculty members and Christian administrators who are already a part of that academic community. Some church folks say that university education is incomplete without a disciplined study of religion, which they say is integral to the social fabric of any society. And how can you be an educated person unless you have some understanding of religion and church life? Campus ministry is on the edges, and I believe rightfully so, because we are in the preaching and in the saving business. Campus ministry sees itself as being on the edges in a unique way, partly because we're like Corinth and Athens and not so much like Jerusalem, and because being not at the center is to be on the edges. And that's where we believe the gospel meets the world. It meets the world of learning and the discipline of higher education in the university setting. Our challenge is to state clearly to the university that the church is present in the university, and furthermore that the church belongs there. Not to coerce and to convert, but rather to witness and to represent a large segment of the society. A third challenge is the way students view campus ministry. Students see the church's campus ministry in different ways at different times during their developmental journey. Some view it as representing tradition and restrictions, and so they rebel against it. They use the new freedom of adulthood that has become theirs as they've left the parental influence and control to not participate in the church. That's part of their freedom. Other students view campus ministry with indifference. They pay absolutely no attention to the invitations to participate in worship or ministry activities. They become so taken up with university life and classwork that they make no special effort to become a part of a community of fellow Christians as together they grow in their faith and their service while they're in the university world. Still other students view us as security because we represent a group of people who hold similar values, who have familiar and secure symbols in the liturgy, a group of people who speak a familiar religious language. And yet other students view us as big brother and big sister. We're there to help them when they need help with roommate tensions or relationship problems or partner relations or drug abuse problems or unwanted pregnancies, but only when they really need the help. That's the big brother and the big sister. And the challenge here is to reissue the call to discipleship in an attractive and a compelling way and to nudge them into considering a renewed commitment to the church. To consider a renewed commitment to the church where they are as students. Fourthly, critics. Many critics of the church and unbelieving atheists and agnostics look at the plethora of different campus ministries and the only thing they can see is a divided house. Squabbling brothers and sisters who preach one thing and live another thing. The divided face of Christianity is proof of the hypocrisy and humanness of Christians who are no different for all of their lofty ideals, according to these people who have many intellectually faculty members in their number. And this critical view really hurts because it's all too accurate, as you know. Christianity does present a divided face. The challenge for us is to move toward greater ecumenical cooperation in ministry, highlighting the similarities that we have in common cause rather than competitively accentuating our differences. And that leads us into the fifth area of the challenge of different parts of the Christian community condemning one another. The denominational ministries, for example, are called churchianity by the parachurch groups or secular humanists by the fundamentalists. Sects such as Campus Crusade or the Navigators or the Way, and cults such as the Moonies or Hare Krishna or Scientology have invaded the religious scene on campuses today, at least in the last 10 to 15 years, in numbers and in ways that were absolutely unthinkable 20 years ago. A colleague of ours in campus ministry, Gil Doan, points up the difference between cults and sects, which I think is helpful. Sects ordinarily stress allegiance to Jesus Christ and to the Scriptures' witness to Christ. That's what they stress, the sects. But the cults preach another gospel, if you're going to use Pauline language. It really isn't a part of the Christian community at all. These sects, who are very critical of the established denominations in their campus ministries, are well-funded. A comparison of the 1983 budgets that they operated under and comparing them with the operating budget of National Lutheran Campus Ministry is kind of interesting. InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, which is basically a non-denominational group that caters to the more fundamentalist mainline denominations, they operated in 1983 with a budget of $17.5 million. Navigators, again, a more fundamentalist Christian group, non-denominational, their budget in 1983 was $22.9 million. Campus Crusade, led by Bill Bright, with the Arrowhead Conference Center and 1,200 chapters across the country, their budget in 1983 was $77.9 million. And the total budget of all income resources for National Lutheran Campus Ministry was $7.1 million. 7.1 verses 17.5 and 22.9 and 77.9. Larger numbers used to be used as authentic proof that God really blessed the efforts of these, quote, genuine ministries. And yet this argument seems to be fading as the numbers fall. Martin Marty in the June 15th issue of Context reported on these changes, and according to Marty, he had interviewed or had correspondence with Tom Schultz, who had written in a youth magazine that, and this is a quote from Schultz, times have changed and that contemporary youth ministry seems to be moving past them. Now what they mean by that is past these non-denominational groups. Young Life director Bob Mitchell says that typical attendance is down for each unit from 75 to 50 on the average. Now that's quite a reduction. They have 1,000 units. Campus Life has 1,200 units across the company. Jay Kessler, a leader with Youth for Christ, says the situation is, quote, not encouraging for us, unquote. Kessler said that most of the parachurch movements were invented on the disaffection of people with the church, unquote. And Young Life admits that it has challenged few young people into the church. Campuses today are the scene of a proliferation of religious groups, sects and cults and mainline ministries of more shapes and varieties and textures and colors than one could possibly imagine. And as university folk and outside observers note, a new dimension has been added to the, quote, religios. The fundamentalists for years have criticized the mainline denominations, the National Council of Churches, the World Council of Churches, as being liberals, as being too concerned about social issues and social justice and public affairs. And these fundamentalists said that these liberal groups were mixing religion and politics. And strangely enough, things have a way of being inverted because the fundamentalists and the ultra-conservatives now have an avowed political purpose. The same group that criticized these liberals as being too political, they now have their own political purpose. Aided by fundamentalist Christian evangelists with vast television audiences, the movement has sought to unite right-wing conservative faith with right-wing conservative politics, and largely around a dozen or so key issues which you all know very well, prayer in the public schools, gun control, the abortion issue, you can tick off the causes. And they have also seen that the political concerns of the mainline denominations have turned to activities on behalf of a different group of issues, civil rights, economic and social justice, war and peace, nuclear and ecological issues, and sanctuary. But the point is, it's a new day among groups in the religious community. While the United States Supreme Court has repeatedly declared that the First Amendment is to be interpreted as meaning, in fact, the separation of church and state, it's not without significance that in church-state relations, the Constitution explicitly places prohibitions on the state and not prohibitions on religion in the churches. According to at least Dr. James Wood, who is the professor of church-state studies at a good Baptist institution, Baylor University. The religious community is divided now on political issues as much as it has been historically divided on doctrinal or ministry practice issues. And this is a challenge to the church. It's a challenge to all of us to get our act together. Get our act together on the call that we all have to be the royal priesthood, the holy nation, God's own people, who've been called out of darkness into God's marvelous light, that we may declare God's marvelous deeds. Well, the final challenge that I'm going to mention today, among the many, many challenges of ministry that we can consider, is the new openness to religion on the part of students. There seems to be, as some term it, a warming trend toward religion among today's students. And of course, the challenge when you think about this is to examine this phenomenon more thoroughly and to build upon it in our ministries. Dr. Patrick Olivelle, who is the head of religious studies at Indiana University, said, "Nationwide, the number of religious studies majors rose more than 30% in the last 10 years, while social science majors dropped 40%. Florida State University has, for example, 15% of the 16,000 undergraduates at that institution taking courses in religion. University of California, Santa Barbara has 33% of their 14,000 undergraduates taking religious courses. In fact, the University of California, Santa Barbara offers 150 courses in religion offered by a religion faculty of 14 full-time professors, 3 part-time professors, and 12 visiting professors. It's amazing, a state university. More students taking courses in religion, and yet Dr. Dean Hoag, who is a sociologist at Catholic University of America, in his research, notes that not only is sexual promiscuity prevalent, but the growing number of incidents of falsification of records, pilfering, and shoplifting indicates weaker personal morals among students." It's interesting. Religious courses are the rage on campus today, but classroom studies are not likely to lead to religious belief or to a change in lifestyle. And so Hoag wrote, "There have been enough studies to show that while involvement in religious courses is growing stronger, religiosity among students is going down. The speculation is that general interest in religion is independent of commitment." Now that's the challenge. It's a need to catch this wave of religious interest, to hopefully ride this wave to a greater call to commitment to Jesus Christ. Studying about religion, including Christianity, is a positive as far as I'm concerned. The interest is there among students, and so extending the call to commitment, helping those students to make the move from curiosity to commitment, is our challenge today. This is a call to vocation, to hear the good news and the call to use one's lifetime and talents and material blessings in serving the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. This is the call to discipleship, to be the church, to be the called out ones, to be the community of the called. The work of campus ministry, I believe, is critically important at this time, especially to God's children who do not know what faith is or might be, God's children who get angry, cynical, confused, or sad when they talk about religion or the church, at least the church as they've experienced it. And it's equally important to others who are lucid and articulate about their faith commitments, but have known frustration in trying to find some kind of a Christian community that shares their spiritual and artistic and ethical and intellectual hungers. And perhaps this heterogeneous group with the one commonality of religious curiosity requires new and strange approaches to communicate this call to commitment. Henry Nouwen referred to the ministry as creative weakness. Creative weakness. He said that ministry is a profession only in the sense of the root meaning of the word to profess. To profess Jesus Christ is to follow him, the Jesus who is vulnerable and who laid down his life. Professing involves sharing one's life as well as one's skills and information. Proclaiming the call to commitment by example. See, me giving my life to Christ, you giving your life to Christ, all of us as the called out community giving our call, our lives to Christ. You see, this is what I think speaks loudly when you talk about commitment. The words, the intellectual ideas are no more than ideologies. But it's the life, the giving of the life. This is what speaks loudly. And when there's this call to commitment with the giving of the life, I think this is what's going to make the difference, not only in university, but in the world. Well, this is a start off on the challenge that we have to ministry. Anything you want to say or critique or challenge or contribute?
Jeff? In my work with the deaf community, I see myself a little bit as a missionary, more than a little bit. And in that work, in the LA area, for example, we rub shoulders with Baptist, Roman Catholic, even Jewish deaf communities. And in almost every situation, I found that the denominational walls begin to shrink, because at least in all the cases except the Jewish tradition, of course, we are struggling together to bring the same word. All of us that I've recognized, that I've worked with in any way, recognize that the gospel of Christ is the bottom line. So it's been really neat for me to sense the larger church working together in mission, united across all the other old boundaries. You talk about yourself in some missionary terms, and yet that same attitude doesn't necessarily prevail on the campus.
Right. It's crazy. In some campus ministry settings, there really is a congregation, and it's not all that dissimilar from a congregation in a community. They deal with different issues. They have, well, maybe not even a more mobile population than you have in certain community parishes. But whenever we have that strong worshiping community, there are different concerns that are expressed. If you have a campus pastor in a setting where there is no worshiping community, the ministry takes a different flavor.
But specifically in relation to other traditions represented on campus, it's more the case that there is fragmentation and division rather than unity in approach?
What we do, John, we have a commitment, first of all, to work ecumenically. That's step one. We try to do that with facilities. The only time we will put up a Lutheran facility is if we can't do it together with the other denominations. I would say clearly one-third of all the campus ministry facilities that we have are in partnership with ecumenical partners. What happens, unfortunately, there's only a set number of ministries on a campus that will really choose to work together. And it seems to be the mainline Protestant groups of the Reformed Methodist tradition, along with the Lutherans, along with the Episcopalians, along with the Catholics. The other fundamentalist group choose to go their own way. The only time we used to see them when I was a campus pastor was once a year we met with the dean of students, and they always showed up for that meeting. They always showed up when it came time to, at that time we still had religious preference cards and distributing the cards. So they got a fix early in the year on where their flock was. But other than that, there was very little cooperation. But our commitment is to do it together as much as possible.
How many schools still permit or have religious preference cards? Do any?
A few do, but very few. It's almost a rarity today. Now, it's an interpretation, I guess, of the separation of church and state. Now, some schools make computer lists available, but they are so sensitive in the questions that they ask for registrants at the university that the information you get is not all that helpful.
It's been a generation since I was on campus as an undergraduate student, or more. But some of these groups that you mentioned were on campus in those days. I think InterVarsity was perhaps the most active in the campus I was at. They had a particular technique and met a particular need that our campus ministry did not. Right. Theirs was primarily in the dorm, 10 o'clock at night Bible studies that lasted half an hour, and did that, and were good at that, I thought. Is that ministry still there and in that form, or has it changed?
Yes, it's still there and very much in that form. For staff, as you know, they have like circuit riders. They rely heavily on a faculty sponsor or a local contact person, a faculty person, and very much student-led ministry on campuses. Their staff people will move around from campus to campus, and they may have a dozen campuses or more that they're responsible for. And they will come and meet with the faculty persons, meet with the student leadership, provide them all kinds of help. InterVarsity does a lot of publishing.
Yeah, in some sense, I did not in those days at least sense that they made the face of religion on campus look more divided. They were sort of a complementary ministry mm-hmm. that addressed a need that we did not as yeah. a denominational ministry.
But for a faculty person, for example, hearing the causes that are espoused by the more fundamentalist groups and then hearing the causes espoused by the more, quote, liberal mainline denominational ministries, it looks divided to them. It looks very much like a divided face. They all keep talking about unity. They all talk about the 17th chapter of John and the great high priestly prayer for unity, and yet what they see, in fact, is a fractured Christianity. And the sentiment runs so deeply on these issues, the abortion issue, for example, or gun control. It just seems as if the Christian community can't really get together. And the question then is it a different gospel? Can it be the same gospel? How can you come out 180 degrees apart consistently as groups?
Some of these others, which one was it you said had the biggest budget? Was that
Campus Crusade,
Bill Bright?
Mm-hmm.
What sort of things do they do on campus?
They have staff who have usually little or no theological training. Many of them are former athletes. They get kind of a Bible training. They have to raise their own salary or income. They work through sometimes teams of two who are like witness teams. They deal in small group Bible study. They try to have rallies, large groups of students who get together. That's pretty much, it's a witness approach to campus ministry. They have four spiritual laws that is in a handy pamphlet, and they try to confront people with, again, the same, we're in the same business. You know, the call to commitment, but it's a different approach to how to do it. And I think you're absolutely right that they serve a function and they reach a different population. The snag is when you throw stones at one another. And we are not without guilt. The mainliners throw our share of stones as well, but what I'm saying is that's a challenge for us, because when the university looks at us, that's exactly what they see, brothers and sisters who can't get their act together. The work of campus ministry is, I think, probably as challenging as any ministry in the church. Part of it, I think, is due to the heterogeneous nature of the people that you're dealing with. Part of, I think, is dealing with the whole faith reason or the whole intellect dimension of the faith, which we talked about the other day. That's a risky thing. Our forefathers, as we said, they sensed the problem. They knew that it was a risky business and you could end up losing the faith, losing a whole ball of wax when you get into this whole world of ideas. And that makes the work, I think, very challenging. The people who come into campus ministry, who are attracted to campus ministry, I think probably have some common features or traits about them. One, I think they feel comfortable in the world of ideas. They are not intimidated by a university climate or atmosphere. It isn't that they don't respect professors, but that they do respect the world of ideas and learning. They feel very much at home with books and libraries, and they feel very much at home dialoguing back and forth about all kinds of issues, including religious issues. They tend not to get defensive when they're challenged. It's like being an apologist, if you think of the history of the church way back when. You go into a worldly, heterogeneous community where you really don't command any respect. You have to earn the respect. And you have to earn it in the arenas of the halls of education, where ideas are king, where the intellect and thinking are king. Commitment is not, that's another dimension that comes in. That's the whole preach and saving business that I talked about. But in academia, they're in a search for truth. You know, is truth here? Is truth? They can't leave one stone unturned if you're going to look for truth. And one idea has no more merit than another, because you're talking about truth here. And the assumption is that there is a truth. And the world of science is trying to discover that, and the world of philosophy is trying to discover that. And given even the pragmatics of a technological revolution, there's a better way of doing it. And anything that's in the past and isn't working as well is junked. You go for the smaller computer chip, or the one that can put more information on it. Or, you know, it's always that moving out ahead into truth. And many of us in the religious community have a hard time dealing with our faith in that kind of an arena, because we aren't all that grounded in our faith to begin with. If you want an experience, argue with a Mooney. Mm-hmm. One came to our door when we lived in Colorado, and he was selling junk for Christian youth. And I said, well, wait a minute. It ended up in about a 20-minute discussion before I threw him off the porch. It wasn't all that easy. You come from different places. You have different assumptions. You use a different sense of logic in trying to reach a conclusion. It isn't all that easy. And that's sort of like what campus ministry can be about. You get into a whole different dimension of the faith. I remember as a parish pastor, evangelism or prospect calling, calling on new members, was an entirely different ballgame. When I went up the door, I did not assume that they were hostile. Normally they had attended a worship service once, and I assumed a set on their part, and that set was at least an openness, not an anger with the church. And it proved out to be true. And then you start talking about commonalities and talking about what's really important in life and what's important for children and what's important for the course of history and how the gospel plays into that. And the next thing you know, they're attending worship regularly. And the next thing you know, they decide to join that Christian community to add their voice and to add their hand to the greater task. In university, it's a different ballgame. And I think that's why Paul had a hard time in Athens, because you're talking about ideas. And one has no more truck or no more stature than another idea.
In terms of what appears to work in some sense in these things, it's always been the case that if there were a charismatic person that gave entree in some of these organizations, the parachurch ones use that technique.
Yep.
As you mentioned, the athletes,
yep.
Young Life mm-hmm. tries to recruit campus leaders.
Mm-hmm.
Does that seem to be a skill or something that is at use on campuses today, and does it give them entree?
I think it attracts a certain segment of the campus population. I think the mainline ordained and lay professionals and priests from the Roman community are probably as diverse a group as you'll find anywhere. I have not seen a commonality of personality, you know, people at all among our staff. We have some who are very outgoing and very gregarious, and we have some who are much more introspective and prefer to spend more time in the library. And that's the style of ministry that goes on is, I think, a direct reflection of that diversity. Those who are more introspective will do much more ministry one-on-one. They will introduce the persons that they're dialoguing with to the great religious writers of history. Those who are much more gregarious and outgoing will be organizers, and they'll bring students in to either do retreat ministry or they'll be involved in causes. I tended to be some kind of a crazy balance in those two, because I do like to be reflective at times, but I was more the gregarious outgoing, and we had students going down to juvenile hall, for example, to try to let the young people who stubbed their toe and ended up overnight or weeks and months in that place, that one was okay, and that there was always the chance for a new start. You could turn a new leaf, and there are all kinds of opportunities if we could just figure out ways to get over some initial hurdles. We had volunteer students going over there every week to do that. Always organizing those types of things. But it's very much a diverse population that works in campus ministry, and what you get in that is a very diverse style of ministry.
My observation of my own children going to large state universities is that the academic load for, if you're in hard sciences, especially in the, and business, is really a tougher road than when I was a student.
Oh yes.
And they really have physically less time for any kind of extracurricular activity.
Exactly. And Ken Knutson, former president of the ALC, who was also president of Lutheran Student Association of America when he was a student at Iowa State University, he was an engineer, as you know. He wrote an article and said that the first task of the Christian student is to be a good student, in fact, to be the very best student. And I think our staff, campus ministry staff, try to honor that and try to encourage students to be the best students. And the demands are greater today than I know when I was a student. There was a lot more time to fiddle and to fool around when I was a student. Today, that intense competition, and it, like most things, they tend to fit together. You got to have the grades to get noticed, to get the job. The competition is consequently greater to get the grades, and so you have to study harder to be competitive. It's very tough on students, and I think that's manifest in lots of ways. One is chemical abuse on campuses. I remember doing a study at the Colorado School of Mines, and I asked a group of students, what's the biggest problem on campus? And they all said drinking. I said, well, when does this happen? When do they drink? Friday night. They get drunk Friday night, and they're sobering up Saturday night, and Sunday they're studying to get back into it the next week. School of Mines is the premier school, as you know, for the whole mining industry. It's like the MIT or the Caltech for mining. And a limited number of people who are accepted to study there, and the competition is absolutely fierce. And they work like crazy all week long, and Friday night they are blotto. Suicide. We've seen in Japan, for example, that teenager youth suicide has always been a leading cause of death among young people in that culture and society. In this country, it's the second leading killer, among college students. Only automobile accidents exceeds it. There's a lot of stress that's going on today, and highly competitive for young people. And of course, what does ministry mean in that setting? Means all kinds of things, I think. One thing is certainly to try and get your... You have to help people to understand what's big and what's little. Because, we get into real gum-ups and we tend to make everything big. We tend to take things that are less important and make them bigger than they really ought to be. And if we, as a ministry, can help people to understand what's really important with what's less important, it seems to me that stress can be much more manageable. You can put it in its proper place. If you don't have that, it's too easy to be a failure. You can't be good at everything. No one is. Leonardo da Vinci was, and a few people like that, but most of us aren't. Three more minutes. Any last questions? Yes.
I do some reading of Christianity Today, which tends to the evangelical side, or the fundamentalist side, I guess you'd say. They had a series of articles in there about a campus organization that I was completely unfamiliar with, called Maranatha something or another. Is that something that is on campuses and
yes.
is sort of a cult? That was what they were sort of insinuating, yeah. that it had cult characteristics.
Yep. Yeah, many of those center in a personality. There's an idea, and it's very attractive to people who do not feel they belong, people who are very lonely. We talked the other night about one of the techniques of the Moonies, for example, as a cult. They hang around laundromats. You know, on vacations, when other students are home, there are always students who don't have anywhere to go, and they do their laundry. By golly, they're there, and they're inviting them. You don't have anywhere to go. We've got this great meal planned, and it's up in the mountains, and all you have, there are going to be lots of people there just like yourself. And
just like they do with clergy.
Yep.
So, yeah. Rise to the Bahamas.
Yep, that's right. Same thing.
Moody's, or that organization, or what?
They sent out the tapes.
A year ago, they invited a whole bunch of clergy to go to the Bahamas to learn about them.
Yeah.
And then this spring, they sent, in our area anyway, every single clergy person received a packet of videotapes and books. If you were buying the stuff, it would cost you $30. And they sent that to everybody.
Yep.
That's a lot of money.
Our district office said, if you've gotten the tapes and you don't want to use them anymore, don't throw them away. Just, if you've got a VCR, use them.
Yeah, raise over, right.
Don't give the district office gold tape over for conventions or workshops or whatever.
Well, there are many voices for students on campus, which are very appealing. And the Christian voice is only one of those. And I think it really is important that we speak that voice with a great deal of clarity as well as appeal.